Okay, guys, we want to thank Imbrico for being our sponsor for this week's show.
Imbrico is a reinforced porcelain tile for outdoor decks with a weight rating of 4,500 pounds with coordinating pedestal, paver, stair, and coping products.
It is ADA approved, skid resistant, scratch proof, perfect for busy family, pool, and grilling areas.
It's installed on conventional code deck framing with deck screws.
Tongue and groove design allows for being installed by local carpentry and decking crew.
It stays cooler to the touch versus composites and concrete and is freeze-thaw resistant, built for extreme climates.
It is also approved for Miami-Dade and Broward County wind uplifts. Thank you, Imbrico.
Thank you, Imbrico. Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. Today, we've got kind of a conversation on technology that grew about, I don't even know what we were talking about, but you asked if I liked history and English in school, right?
Yeah, and then I remembered you were more the math science guy.
Yes.
And I think history is such a huge part of building, and like I'm doing this book right now. I was listening to it. It was in the car. It's called Fever in the Heartland. It's about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. And then I was like, looking at you like you're not really a history guy, and so I was asking whether you're a math science or English history guy.
I think I'm an anything guy if it's got application. Like I think I was drawn towards the math science because math and science are incredibly applicable.
Are they though?
Yes, incredibly so.
Like in my business, how are math science?
Are you kidding me? In your business? One, in business, money is so applicable. Like percentages are how you make margin in your pricing of things. And like, how do you put together a price sheet? How do you put together a bid for a job? How do you, like, that's all math.
Okay.
And then on top of that, like what I'm doing.
Science? How would science apply to math?
That is math. That is, science is math applied.
Okay.
In a lot of ways. Like physics is. You're crazy. How are you not? You use chemistry all the time. Like you use every, okay.
Do I though?
I think you're trying to piss me off. If you're putting limestone together, if you're trying to put together some sort of compound, if you're trying to put together a rock, if you're trying to put together that's all science. Any sort of paint that you put together, that's science. If you're trying to cut wood, that's science. Like,
yeah, but you know, come on.
I think you are messing with me. The way that blades cut on a saw, there is physics involved in trying to figure out the most optimal way of cutting through a fiber of a wood.
Says the dork.
You're crazy if you don't think you've got science involved in what you do. I think all the school subjects are really cool. Says the dork. I'll just stop there. I think all the subjects in school are cool. I think they're cool if they apply to what you're doing. Like right now, I think history is really cool when it's the right history. Like you're like the rise and fall of the Ku Klux Klan, and I'm like, I'm not racist, so I'm not into that. But you're apparently in. I'm just kidding. I don't know why you're into it, but you're really interested in some history. No, I'm just kidding. But what I'm saying is,
did you know in the Prohibition era that you used to be, so Prohibition, you know, no alcohol, but please. You could get a prescription from your doctor every 10 days to go to the pharmacist and get alcohol.
What?
That was one of the workarounds, and that Charles Walgreen.
Yeah.
Grew his stores from like 12 to like 480 stores around the country because of that loophole in Prohibition.
No way.
Isn't that crazy?
I didn't know Walgreens was a name.
So there! In your face, Jackson! In your face!
But I think what I'm trying to say is if something applies to what you're doing, it is immediately the coolest thing ever. You know what I mean? Like,
is that one of the prescriptions for...
Gotta get some whiskey. Gotta go to my doc. Bootleg botanicals.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh my gosh. That's like unofficial print bootleg botanicals. That looks like money.
Prescription form for medicinal liquor. Look at that at the top.
You were about to say medicinal.
What if I was?
But you know what I'm saying? Like everything is cool if it applies in a certain way to what you're doing.
I think just that's our brains are different because I hated math science. And yet your mom is like, you're actually really good at math.
You're a really good math guy.
And so.
Why do you hate math? Like you use it all the time.
I don't hate math. I'm looking more about it at school. I did not. Yeah, I was not a math student in school.
I think a lot of that goes to how they teach stuff in school.
I agree.
I think if they took us, I mean, it's easy to say if they took us on more field trips, school would have been way cooler. But that's because you're doing stuff and you're seeing stuff. But I think if they like were more applicable in how they introduce things.
And I think that's true with math, out of the history for sure, because history isn't just a bunch of dates.
History's the most boring subject in school
if
you're just learning it like, and then the Civil War.
1492.
I wish they taught history more like they do in our program, where they're like, what do you think the ramifications were for this? This was being built in this style. Why do you think they would have done that? And then you're like, I don't know. And then they give you the answer. You're like, oh, that makes sense. Like, it makes sense that we were a new colony. We didn't really have a style. So there was no previous buildings here. So they went to another thing they went to another country to look for their styles. And it was the place where they were all colonized from. Like, that makes sense. And then Victorianism. Like the rise of Queen Victoria and her prevalence over the world. Like, oh my gosh, that starts to make sense. And then when you look at like how things are dated and how things are put back, when you're looking at nails, all of a sudden the manufacturing of nails becomes really interesting. But if you're reading about, today we're going to learn about the manufacturing of nails in a book, you're like, okay, what are we doing here? Why are we learning about nail manufacturers? And then it's like, I'm taking apart a home. How are you going to identify it? Well, they wouldn't have had cut nails back then. They would have had wrought nails. They would have had, you know, cast nails. They would have had, now you're like, oh, that actually is really cool that I know that. And I think anything just becomes cooler, like if you've got kind of a party trick associated with it. You know what I mean?
True.
Because if you're like at a party and someone's like, what do you do? And you're like, I'm in historic millwork. Everyone's kind of like, okay, snoozer alert. You know what I mean? But then if you're like, that part of the house was brand new, that was added on later, and everyone's like, what do you mean, how do you know?
Remember
that
Tom Cruise movie where that he's asked at a party, what do? He goes, I'm a traffic engineer, as if that's the most boring possible thing.
Mission Impossible 3.
Is it that one?
I think so.
So yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
And so he goes
with his wife.
Yeah,
exactly.
So as if that was the most boring thing.
Right.
I actually have like 20 questions for the traffic engineer.
Yeah.
Because traffic, as you know, I tend to drive fast.
What?
Cops,
get them.
When you go and these lights or every other light is not synchronized and you go, you speed up, stop. I go, just synchronize the freaking lights. And with this whole thing, you know, there's a 377 in Benbrook is the most frustrating. I will drive around that a mile out of my way to avoid that thing. So when he said traffic engineer, I perked up. Oh, really? I'd like to ask. And I think they set it up as like the most boring possible profession.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I don't even remember his job from that movie. Like I didn't know he said traffic engineer because I was like, ho-hum. Like Ethan Hunt is way cooler than a traffic engineer. Or whatever that job may be. So it's really funny that you actually remember. He goes, traffic engineer.
I'd like to ask that guy some questions.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine the guy cornering him in a party? Okay, so. And I even remember he said, did you know the brake lights on a car can transfer back to like a 200 mile time thing? I remember what he said. Isn't that the worst? Oh my gosh.
We gotta find a clip of that.
Yeah,
that
we do need to find a clip.
You hit the brakes for a second, just tap them on the freeway. You can literally track the ripple effect of that action across a 200 mile stretch of road because traffic has a memory. It's amazing. It's like a living organism.
Oh my gosh, I cannot believe it.
Because I remember the statistic he threw out and why I thought that was interesting. And I sit there and go, yeah, I know, I've noticed that.
As a side note, there's a one that got me. Have you seen the video on why airplanes are loaded in the most inefficient way possible?
No.
Oh, it's so fascinating. It talks about how the best way to load an airplane would be if like the outer edges are A and F, the most efficient way to load a plane would be to start at the back of the plane with all A's and all F's and have everyone alternate AF, AF, AF. And then so you go 34, 33, 32, 31, 35, and everyone gets on the plane in that order. And then the people in the back, they put their bags up, they go get in their seats, and then the next ones come in. And so it's
that
like
would be the most efficient way to load a plane.
To load a plane.
The passengers, not the
passengers. Yeah. And so they like do math on like how to cut down time in the loading part. Because if you've been on a plane, they do it front people first, and then the front people get off first. But it would make way more sense if the front people loaded on last, if they did the back first and then the front. You know what I mean?
I just read an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal about the efficiency engineers, and they were talking about government in overall being kind of an inefficient way to manage people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using the example of people emptying the stadium.
Yeah.
It ends up, if you try to mandate that or have people kind of flagging, you go,
yeah,
it would take a week to unload the stadium. And yet stadiums can go from completely full to completely empty in 20 minutes
oh
or
my gosh,
15
yeah.
minutes. And you're like, how?
But you put regulation
yeah,
in
you
it.
You put
and
regulation
all of a sudden
in and
it
ends up going.
Down.
And that's what makes me sit there and go, you're trying to mandate that. I wonder if that's still. But you're right. I think loading the people from the front is.
Well, part of that is it's all one choke point. Whereas
right,
with a stadium, it's like just have people follow signs to the exit sign, you know, because there's like 9 different exits.
Okay, now it is a boring conversation.
But you see what I'm saying? Like anything is really interesting if it's applicable, if it's made applicable. And so like I think English was applicable to me the first time when I was like studying the Bible for K-Life. I was like, okay, I wish I'd paid more attention in English class because I'm using this stuff now. And then math,
the
like,
poetry, the storytelling
yeah,
versus
some of the Bible is allegory, some of it's not allegory. Right. Then you're like, well, how do you know? Well, read it like a literary book, and then you can start to figure it out. Then also trigonometry, we just use that all over our house.
Dork alert.
Yeah, I bet you know trigonometry on like just.
I don't know what trigonometry is. I couldn't tell you
it's how the angles can play with one another.
That's not geometry.
It's geometry, but. You can do math equations to figure out what angle is what based on.
So the question was,
yeah,
you were a math science geek and I was a history and English geek, yeah. Right? And so it's interesting to me that the books I read are almost all either about building, about architecture, or they're history books.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily love novels. I'll probably read, you know, 3 novels a year.
Yeah. I've already read 4 novels this year.
Yeah. So
it's January 22nd.
Yeah. You've shown me some books. I've actually read those. I think those are interesting.
We just have good taste.
Well, in any case, it's interesting now that you're following the path to this thing that because I sit there and go, gosh, history is a huge part of this. And I think you're starting to see that now.
Well, it's so funny because I hated history in school and I tried to be a history major for a little bit and I was like,
really? I didn't know that.
I tried because I was supposed to be an easy subject, and I went to class and snooze alert.
That is so funny because I could not handle the business school. To go to an accounting class or an economics class.
If I was smarter.
My savior was history and English.
Yeah. If I was smarter, I would have gone business because that would have been a better blow off for me than history would have.
Yeah, you would have liked the math.
But I would be in a different field right now, I think.
Yeah, that's probably true.
If I graduated a business major, I'd be in a different field, I think. It's almost like it comes alive the more I know about homes and stuff. It's almost like I wish I knew more about X subject. Now I need to go do research on it. And I get excited to do research on it because I want to learn more for the reasons of wanting to learn more. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So like when Steve was talking about the first period homes and we're like talking about the first period design of homes, he's like, it's common for Georgian to have a central chimney. Why is it common for them to have a central chimney? Chimneys were typically built on the outside of homes. Well, they would merge 2 homes together, and now all of a sudden you've got a central chimney. And I was like, oh, that's crazy.
Or you have one chimney that heat 4 rooms in a house.
Right.
Yeah.
But it didn't originally start out that way. It started out where the chimneys were on the outsides of the house, and then when they merged homes together, then it started to become the build style.
I don't know if that's true. That's what he just said?
So it was explained to us, yeah. That helped dictate that being the new style for whatever reason.
I think you have that backwards. Because the early Georgian periods were a central chimney house.
Because the first period homes were not central chimney, and they would take Tim's whole family just moved. I'm going to take his house, put it on rollers, and push it together with mine, and now we've got a central chimney. That's like one of the identifiers of Georgian. That's what he said.
You had to have misheard that.
Maybe.
Because the most efficient way to build the house and heat it was to build the chimney in the center of it and have it heat the four different rooms of the house.
I agree with you that makes sense, that it's the most efficient.
No. And it's second period houses, federal houses, where the chimneys are separated onto the two ends of the house. It's not the first colonial thing that the chimney was off to the side and they joined the houses together. I don't know if I've ever heard the story of them joining houses to make a Georgian house. So anyway, I'd be interested because I believe you and I believe that Steve knows what he's talking about, but I think you misheard that.
Because I don't think I did. I'm just thinking, like, we went to a physical example of one of these homes. They had all these stats on the home, and Chandler was one of the architects that worked on restoring the homes in, like, the 1930s. Like, Chandler's the guy.
Famous preservation guy.
Yeah, first preservation carpenter. And there's, like, a section of the house that's very clearly he's worked on it. And then there's another section of the house that hasn't been worked on. And Steve said, I think this was the original home, and I think this was dragged to this home because of the way that the marriage marks of the home are and the way that the two ends have met. But it's got it doesn't have a central chimney, but now the home does have a central chimney, but it didn't.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is how often they moved houses in that period of time.
And
I mean,
moved them.
Yeah.
Like over miles.
Yeah.
Not just like, let's push it my neighbor to another one.
No, a long way.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Because the thought of moving a home now is like, like the ones on the highway.
Yeah.
You know? It's like it's a metal framed,
right?
You know, sheet home.
Yeah, it's a mobile home.
It's crazy.
It is. Anyway, I'd love to know more about that. So, but the technology that we're talking about that I think basically drives home construction.
Yeah.
And the Industrial Revolution. If you look at, you know, the top five things that changed home building, the Industrial Revolution, right, and then trains, right? That those two pieces together are the things that changes. And then World War II. World War II would be three because of the changes after World War II. And then what would be four?
Did you just kind of throw out four as a number, or were you like, there are four things?
No, I said the top five things. If I was going to, guessing that there'd be five things. But those three, it probably stand out to me as just the Industrial Revolution, because you have cut nails versus, you know, wrought nails, cut nails, wire nails, right? Changing the way houses are built, timber framing down to balloon framing, you know, down to Western framing. And the way houses are framed is partly due to the fact that we have nails and we're nailing boards together as opposed to joining them together. You have the Industrial Revolution being taking hand plane moldings to machine moldings to tongue and groove floors to, you know, standardization. And I've had long talks about that. You just take those three things: Industrial Revolution, trains, which you could consider part of that, and then World War II. And you are talking about nearly all of the changes that have changed home building. Because in my theory is that you had two things that change a house style.
From what to what, I guess.
Right, from anything to anything, okay? From Georgian to federal to Greek Revival to Victorian, right? All of those, what changes? Why do those house styles change? And they were either changed because of sociological issues or because of technological changes, right? And so the Georgian to federal, okay, would be a sociological issue, right? We are rebelling against England. We had called that period the Georgian period because of King George. In England, it becomes the Adamesque period. We call it the federal period. And so there is a disassociation.
They call it Adamesque, like John Adam?
No, Robert Adam, the British architect.
Instructor.
The British architect who basically went to Pompeii, okay, realized what was really going on in Pompeii, what was really going on with Roman architecture. Yeah. And started this new classical or new
like,
era.
Like how the interiors are foofy and everything.
Yeah, exactly. So That's a sociological change. There wasn't really technology that changed anything. Now, there were technological changes that they applied. For instance, composition moldings weren't you know as popular, and so there were things like that. So that's a sociological change. Another sociological change would be the Victorian to the arts and crafts. This rejection of this over-ornamented. There was a change in mood, change in desire, change in taste that caused people to look at the Victorian and go, gross, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. And you go to a simpler form of architecture, right? Mm-hmm. Again, another sociological change. Technological change would be, you know, the things I'm describing, the groundbreaking thing, effects of the Industrial Revolution that we don't build houses the same way. We don't have moldings the same way. We don't build the same way. Houses are assembled instead of, you know, crafted one by one.
Right.
Anyway, so yeah. I just think that, well, going back to our conversation, that those things are so powerful that I feel like you need to understand those things, and makes me sit there and go, he needs to be reading, you know, these books to really understand kind of how these are put together. Didn't know if you were interested in that.
Not interested. Yeah, I've heard all your.
Yeah, whatever.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, all that stuff sounds. I mean, just to put it all in perspective, we're learning about all this stuff, and we're in our program, and we're going through everything. Steve gives us book recommendations all the time, and I'll frequently buy the books that I feel like are super applicable and relevant. I mean, I bought a book about this. The book is literally called Understanding Wood. So I think
Bruce Hoadley.
Yeah. You know the book. But I mean, I'm like really interested in that book and trying to figure it out and understand.
Wood,
like,
movement and everything.
Yeah, exactly. Wood movement, the fibers. The funniest part about that whole book is it is a very dense book. It's a very textbook.
Yes.
It's good, but it's...
It's a textbook. There's
no
doubt.
It's not like Slate Bible's good. Like, it's fascinating. It's fun to read. That book is like, it's helpful information, but it's like a textbook.
Like a textbook? It is a textbook.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. No.
But the first sentence of the book is, wood comes from trees. Literally, wood comes from trees. This is the first thing you must understand about wood. And then it kind of goes into how there's fibers.
Wait, what?
Yeah, right?
What in the world?
It's a funny, like... that. You say it's dense, but I'm kind of like, this guy had to have a sense of humor. He may not have. They tell us stories about this guy. There's another thing, like, anything's cool if it's got an interesting thing to it. They were telling us about dendrochronology, and dendrochronology is how you date wood, and you can tell if you're in a region that has a good dendro team. You've got to be in the right region for it. There's got to be enough information because the weather plays a huge pattern into it. But what they'll do is they'll take these timber frame homes and they'll drill in from the bark wood all the way to the pith, and then they'll
piss the middle of the tree.
Yeah. And they'll take that and they'll match it up against a series of wood grains from other years in the same area, and they'll be able to date when the tree was felled and when it was used. And so you can,
because they can look at the growth rings and see droughts, or they can see fires, yep, or they can see other things. And
it's
very
region specific. Yeah. It's not just like, all right, I'm in the Northeast, I can do this across the Northeast. It's like, I'm in West Boston, now I can do it, you know? It's like it's crazy. But it's specific for a reason, because there's regional fires.
And the reason you do that, you're looking at an historic house and you're saying, I wonder when this was built. Was it 1720 or was it 1690?
Right.
And they date the wood and they go, well, this was felled this time. And so,
and they've got to date a couple of pieces of wood, because what can happen is Tim, the, you know, your neighbor could have lost his job.
Talk about joining houses together. Yeah,
they could have torn down his house and used a beam from one house to another. Anyway, so there's a lot of cool stuff in dendrochronology. And so they were explaining.
I've always thought there could be a crime show or a.
Yeah. Okay. Did you hear about this guy?
No.
But Bruce Hoadley did this.
What?
He solved a murder where.
Come on.
I'm telling you, the FBI called him and they were like, we've got a baseball bat that was used in a murder and it has blood in it. And it, you know, we need you to be able to tell us what type of wood it was, where this bat was manufactured, so that we can figure it out. And he did, and they figured it out. Isn't that crazy?
I think there's a crime. There's a whole book of a
like Psych style. Like,
yeah, it's something where like you're brought back from time or something like that. and in the future they're asking you to explain
yeah
like this house or this architecture because there was a murder in it or something.
There's a high need for that. They're in the future, there's a bunch of aliens like explain this house to me.
Why do you need to know? If the last 50 years of home building it means nothing, right? There is no style, then 100 years from now they might be looking at it going, what does this even mean?
Right.
You know, and because nothing means nothing, right, going forward, that we're all living in cubicles.
Yeah.
And that there is an architectural style. But anyway, that's a side thing.
Yeah.
But there is enough weird science and weird way of knowing things.
There really is.
That it could be the kind of clues that Sherlock Holmes walks into a house and he sees, well, you've got that there. That doesn't apply with that there. And so anyway.
There has to be murder involved.
That's what I'm going
to
do in my second career.
Yeah. It's hard because houses don't typically commit murders, you know?
They don't. They slay us emotionally.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly. You.
There's some houses that could kill. They're so ugly.
Yeah. You know what's funny? Natalie keeps making fun of me because I keep doing what you do, I'm assuming.
What's that?
I'm like, oh, that house is great. Or, I can't believe they
were
that.
Thinking?
What are they thinking? There was a house I drove by the other day that had, it looked like stickers. Like it wasn't a sticker, but it looked like stickers. It was pretty funny that their shutters for a rectangular window were the shutters for a ovular window, like a oval at the top, like a rounded. And like, what in the world? You kind of do the like spatial game of like, what would it look like with those closed? And I mean, like literally if you closed the windows, it would look like there were two little half circles of glass on either side where the window wasn't covered. It was like, who's doing that?
Yeah, no, it's
doing too much.
Ludicrous.
You're telling me.
So we're talking about technology.
Talking about the railroad.
I threw out some stuff and I'm waiting for a reaction.
Oh, sorry. Wait, what did you say? I don't remember actually.
I talked about the three different periods of technology and the three different periods.
Yeah. What was the, like, so there's technological changes, there's sociological. Is it socialism?
See, I lost you here when I was explaining all this. So I figured that's what was going on.
No, I don't think you asked me a question. I think you just were done talking.
No, I threw out a pretty big zinger.
Well,
and you missed
zinger?
It.
Yeah, I missed it. Did I really miss it? I'm like, I don't think I missed anything. It's talking about wood.
I have had conversations and videos of like, I think it's pretty fascinating that styles change.
Yeah.
Okay.
You think it's fascinating that styles change?
Absolutely. Why would styles change? Because
clothing styles change, because phone styles change, because every style changes. People get bored with certain styles, I think.
But styles, here's why it's fascinating, is because architecture reflects culture. Architecture reflects, you know, who we are, what we believe, what we value, what we think is important, right? And if you look at, you know, Georgian, Federal, and things like that, it's curious to me that all of a sudden we'd be making houses with moldings that are strong and bold, and we do raised panels, and then 20 years later, everything's flat panels. We'd never do raised panels again. We don't start doing raised panels again until the Victorian era.
Right.
And I think that's, like,
you're saying that like it's a zinger? Is that what you mean?
It's kind of a zinger. It's kind of like, it's like... Is it?
Here's why I don't think it's a zinger.
If people don't know,
yeah,
they'd be like, "Well, why do they change? Why is this changing?"
I don't think people look at it and go, "Why is that different?" You know what I mean? Like, do you look at?
Yeah, they do.
Do you look at clothes?
Because the number one question people want to know, is when was my house built?
Yes.
What, you know?
I don't think they know why was my house.
Why does it look the way it does? What's going on with that? And you're looking at it like, yeah, no, no, it's. It's like,
I guess I'm just thinking about this. I'm thinking about this. When I'm in Boston, they are like at Victorian homes.
Right.
And I'm like, what do you mean? Victorian homes are awesome.
Right.
Like, especially when they're done well, there's so much detail in them. There's so much cool things. There's like a variety. There's, I don't know. There's like, it's not just, this is the Victorian style. It looks like a cookie cutter. Like you pull it up on Google. It's like, yep, Victorian. But it's like, there's Queen Anne, there's Italianate, there's stick, there's all these fun things. And so I guess in my mind, I'm like, Victorian style is awesome. But they look at Victorian style and they're like, it's kind of a cheapened version of like what our real historical, like whatever. But then shift to Texas, where I'm from, Victorian style homes are the oldest style homes. And so it's like, look at these Victorian homes. And it's like, whoa, they're so cool. There's history in them. There's all this stuff. But it's because everything past them is not as old or historic or as neat or as cool. Or like, there's almost not this reverence around them. Every time someone brings them up, it's almost just like, yep, that's a Victorian home, you know? And so I guess I'm just kind of like, I think styles change because people get bored with them. Like, think about how last 60 years, there's not like a design style, right? There's not like...
I mean, I would argue there's not.
It's all cookie cutter. It's all like a house style house. It's not like there's anything crazy.
It's a builder assembled right. Ugly mess.
I think they're going to have a name for it in a couple of years. And I think it's going to turn into, yeah, that wasn't a very good style, but it was a style home. And I think, you know, people will try and replicate it with better materials and try and like homage to this.
Please tell me that's not true.
Well, I'm just thinking about like the high-end home versus the low-end home. I don't think people will ever try and replicate the McMansion. I do think this is like a stain on like design and style homes. But I just think right now, like, okay, probably ranch and like modern farmhouse style homes.
The two most popular styles today is the modern farmhouse and barn dominiums.
Yeah. So I think modern farmhouse is already turning into a little bit of like a, people are getting sick of the design and they're going to start moving. Not everyone, because it is the hot trend right now, or it was at least like a year and a half ago. But I think it's going to start losing that luster, and then people are going to want to change
but here's
to
the deal.
Style.
Okay. Here's you're mostly correct.
Right? Like, people get bored of styles. But then it becomes cool when you start to look back and you're like, yeah, that was in for a while. Now it's out.
If you look at the things that change are these architectural styles, mm-hmm. okay? And I'm arguing it's taste,
yeah.
which is sociological changes,
yeah.
okay?
And then innovation.
And technology,
yeah.
okay? Alliteration, Jackson, taste and technology. Let's just stick with that, okay?
Okay, English guy.
The thing that's scary to me, okay, is what you described, is that we here in, you know, North Texas, our oldest houses are Victorians.
Yeah.
Unless you look at the log cabin things that are really settler stuff.
Not the settlers, like the
right.
early
so,
permanent.
So Victorians, and then the Victorians in arts and crafts and period revival is our housing stock, is our historic yeah. housing stock.
Yeah.
And then you go out to like, I don't know if Burbank, California is an old town, but let's
probably
just
ranch.
Let's
probably
just,
like,
let's just say it's not, but it gets settled later. It's a newer city.
Yeah.
And they don't have anything historic there.
Right.
And so their oldest houses are from the 50s.
Modern.
And so it's a mid-century yeah. style, right? I guess what I'm sitting there, as I look forward into the future and look at house styles and stuff like that. And if it's true that since 1970, we haven't had a new house style,
mm-hmm.
and we only describe the recent house yeah. styles with derogatory statements like McMansions,
yeah.
starter castles, cookie cutter,
yeah.
shiplap, you know, Joanne and Chip Gaines,
yeah.
modern farmhouse.
I think farmhouse modern is the only positive one.
Any case is
do you not?
I mean,
I think it's one. I don't think it's like a crazy,
it's not a derogatory statement,
right? That's
right?
what I meant,
and so. It's
not necessarily the best style in the world, but it's one that like is at least somewhat positive, where it's like it has a style, it has a direction, it has a vision, it's simplistic, it doesn't draw on a lot of the past, but it's like in. I don't know
what my point is. It's just that if taste and technology are the things that have changed architectural styles, okay, we've almost gone into a period of fast fashion,
yeah.
okay, where it nothing matters, okay. Build it cheap, build it fast, you know, throw it in the dump. And it's just fashion styles used to be something that changed once a year, and every few years you would have these changes. Now you have fast fashion is every 3 months there's a new look and a new style and a new things going on. And I'm afraid that our architecture, our houses are becoming, you know, functional widgets mm-hmm. that have no style and are disposable and are junk, okay? And is taste and technology changing that? Well, if it's taste that's changing, if that's sociological preferences that are changing that, if we as a society are looking at houses as disposable, as is not something you live in for a long time, it's just 5-7 years and I'm yeah. out of there, And a lot of the products that were put in our houses are that way.
Yeah.
I mean, those flat windows that are made of plastic, that, I mean, that's a 6-year, 10-year window at the longest.
Yeah.
And people don't care that that's the life of the thing. I mean, you could probably point to 5 or 6 products that we're putting in our houses today that I could guarantee you will not last.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, okay, well, you know, how much can I buy? How big a house can I get?
Yeah.
There's a trend that maybe a technological jump comes along that all of a sudden improves that or changes that, but we're headed in a really scary direction.
No, I agree with that. I think when you look at technology as like a major driver in this thing, like the technology's been driving us away from being able to have good home styles.
Technology's driving us away from having good home styles.
Because, you don't think so?
Because it's speeding things up. Because it's
Because it's speeding things up.
It's simplifying things so bad. We skip methods.
Every technological advance has been less focused on like, well, maybe it always has been like this, but it's more focused on how can I do this quicker and more efficiently and easier. And so, I think when you do that,
that's what a technological advancement is, I guess.
Right, but it almost doesn't factor in the lifespan of the product. And so if you have a lifespan of a product like the Snap-on vinyl, like sidings or whatever, that's not considered. But the speed that you set it up, the cost of it, and the material that it's made out of, that's all considered.
Considered how?
Like how cheap can I get the material? How fast can I put it up? How
the
easy
clips
is it
are
to do?
How fast I can put it up. How easy, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've always said that we are dumbing ourselves down. The problem with Home Depot and a Lowe's is that they are teaching not only homeowners how to do things cheap and fast, they're teaching tradesmen to do that cheap and fast as well.
Yeah.
And so when you have snap-in-place tile and, you know, and you are dumbing down the process with technology.
That's what I'm saying is the technological advancements that are happening right now in our homes.
It's just a scary specter to think about what houses look like in 30 years, okay?
Well, that's where I'm also kind of like, I think taste will balance it back out because I think, you don't think taste will back it back out? I think if you held up a farmhouse, modern house, and a like period revival home against one another, and you're like, which one do you want to live in? I think people would 9 times out of 10 choose the other one, but they would go, it's too expensive. It costs too much to do. I can't afford that house. I can afford the simpler one because it's cleaner lines. It's less, it seems like there's less going on. So it seems like it would be cheaper to live in the farmhouse modern than it would to be live in the other one. And that's where people almost self-disqualify themselves, like self-select themselves
You are choosing the car because it gets the best gas mileage, not because it's good looking.
I think so.
Anyway, there's something going on there. I didn't really mean to get into a futuristic conversation about what the future of houses is, but stylistically, unless someone comes along, the Elon Musk of cars comes along and says, "Here's how to build beautiful, inexpensive houses,"
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's, you know, pleasing both people, right?
Yeah,
you know, and realize too that if you look at, you know, the majority of houses being built today are meant for a starter or a level 2 house as opposed to a
forever
home that's a generational house and mm-hmm. things like that. That Elon Musk I'm describing is going to fill the void of the 80% out there, not the 20%.
Yeah.
And so, which will change things. But, you know, someone's got to come along and solve that cheap and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's done that yet. The problem with getting something beautiful from the cheap side is that most of those guys who solve the cheap side aren't interested in the beautiful side.
Yeah, I think the person who's going to solve the cheap and beautiful is going to be building their own home and is going to be doing it affordably and is got to just care about design.
I think it's going to be built in a factory. I think that the next house that will be built like that will be something that can be manufactured cheap and fast and yet controlled with a design team that's going to make it beautiful.
How is that going to be good, though?
Did I say good? I said cheap. You know, ideally I think there's a standard for it withstanding, you know, wind and rain and cold and things like that, that will be standardized
like the framing is done on site and then it's all.
No, it's brought in a box. So it's brought in a number of pieces, then it's assembled on a house.
Unless you're building, like, just knowing structurally how a lot of these things come together now, I'm just like, I don't even know how you could do that without making these things come together.
Well, I mean, you know, what if that technological jump is, you want that house? Okay, it'll be ready in a month. You buy that? Okay, it'll be here. We'll start.
That is a technological advancement.
We'll start assembling it in 3 weeks. You should have your house and be ready to move in. Get your bags ready, because we'll be ready for you to move in, you know, in a month. And you're looking at the product going, wow, that's great. It's two bedrooms, you know, it's one bath. We got a study. They can start working on the landscaping, because the house will come in and drop in and assemble in this amount of time. I think that's what the future of home building is.
That'd be crazy.
I don't know how we solve the current level of problems that we've got right now without that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I just think there has to be a swing in design choices. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if I'm using clothes as an example, the 70s was kind of a stain on clothing styles, right? Like hammer pants, disco, all that kind of stuff. We moved away from that, right? And I think we moved away from that out of a stylistic thing. Like, if you look at what has lasted through clothing-wise, like, some of the things are called classic for a reason, you know, because they're, like, classics. You go back, 80 years, and people are wearing some of those things. Like, but then also think about some of the clothes today. There's, like, a trend in people being really dressed up for a lot of things, moving away from that. Like, people don't wear full suits to work anymore. Like, all the finance guys are wearing button-ups and Patagonia jackets, not full suits anymore. And so we're seeing this kind of, like, downward trend in terms of casualness and fighting for comfort, I think. And so we lose a lot of that. And I almost think, like, Farmhouse Modern is that, like, trade-off where people are saying, like, I want something that's not a McMansion. I want something that's not made out of cardboard, but I want something, you know, that's going to be different, but more casual, less bits and bobs.
But you're describing a fashion desire, and I'm describing a technological leap.
But the culture is the same. I think it says a lot about the culture regardless.
What is it saying about the culture?
I just think people want a more casual feel, want a more like...
No, I mean,
and I think that's where the Farmhouse Modern is fitting that realm. I think people see the live edge wood and they're like, live edge, but...
Well, no, I mean, I've said before that our Victorian house was the McMansion, okay?
What do you mean by that?
Well, the Victorian house was a showy house. There was a lot of technological advancements. There was a lot of... It was the desire to have everything. Okay, and you look at the McMansions with the arches and the crown moldings and the granite countertops and all the different things that are thrown in there to wow and you know, make a big splash.
Yeah,
all the pediments on the front of those houses and everything else. You know, the modern farmhouse or the cottage movement that Chip and Joanna were pushing was a back to simplicity.
Yeah,
just like the arts and crafts movement was a reaction to the Victorian.
Yeah,
so I agree with you that there is that the modern farmhouse and that cottage movement, that simpler style, is an aesthetic that people like and appreciate, and it does feel right at this point in time.
I think there's gonna be a swing back. Like, I think people are gonna want that nice again, and they're gonna look how far back, like, they're gonna look at the McMansion and go, we don't want that, but we want it good, you know.
Well, I think that's why we're building a lot of classically designed. People are resonating with my videos on the classical design, classical moldings, and they want to know, how do I implement that in my house?
Yeah.
And I get that everybody wants that classic look, which I think would be a formality people would be going back to. You know, I'm not disagreeing with your point. I'm talking about that, you know, that addresses the 20% that care about beauty and care about, you know, how things look.
Yeah.
I think there's a 80% there that just want a functional tool, for living. And I think they want a Tesla. I think they want a practical, easy to use car that has cool mm-hmm. factor to it.
Yeah.
That's what I think houses are going to end up becoming.
Yeah. I think something that's funny and semi-ironic about your analogy to Tesla is I don't know a lot of car guys. I don't know enough about cars. But the one car guy I know, Nathan, I asked him one time, like, do you just think the Tesla is so cool? Because I look at the Tesla and I'm like, it's great. And he's always been an Audi guy, a BMW guy, like really like kind of faithful to German, whatever. And he was like, I think the Tesla is scratching an itch for a lot of people and like doing something for a lot of people. But every time they're shipped, they are like, there's always little manufacturing flaws with them. And it's almost like they're not necessarily the most well-built thing in the world, but they always have these little, you know, flaws here and there. So it is kind of funny that you're almost advocating for a Tesla as a house when it's might be equated to a 1960s cookie cutter home.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, when I look at a Tesla, I don't look at it as if it's an Audi or a Mercedes or a finely engineered German automobile.
Yeah.
I look at a Tesla as a scratching a lot of itch for the average guy who wants something cool because it looks cool.
Right.
But you dive down below that and there's not a lot there.
Right.
And so, but you know, driving around, it's cool.
And it's got a lot of get up too.
And the driver experience is different and therefore kind of, you know, novel and kind of interesting. So
I'm not knocking Tesla. I know nothing about them. So I've never owned one. I've never driven one, but Nathan was saying like, sometimes they come.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I just think, I think of all the callbacks on all the different makes and models of cars that I think they all have glitches and problems,
but you're kind of, you want a Cybertruck, don't you?
I actually hated the Cybertruck. I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
But I've seen enough of them now. I was like, that's actually kind of a cool looking looking automobile that I think I look at and I go, I can kind of see the appeal. I don't think I want to drive one.
Yeah.
But I hear they're fast.
You don't want to drive
one. I hear they're fast.
That's dangerous. We should not put you behind the wheel. One of those.
I'm Chevy guy now, and I really like the GMC Chevy lineup. That's where I'm at.
Great. All right. Thanks for watching this episode, and we'll see you in the next one.